Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, was facing a May 28th trial date in an Oklahoma lawsuit, a trial that would have featured cameras in the courtroom. Instead, this week the company opted to settle for $270 million, a larger sum than the two previous state lawsuit settlements involving the company's role in the opioid epidemic. It comes just as Purdue is facing other investigations, and as institutions around the world distance themselves from the company and its owners, the Sackler family.
A Massachusetts lawsuit is the first to name some of Purdue Pharma's owners, eight members of the Sackler family, and other executives, claiming they participated in a deadly and illegal scheme.
Britain's Tate Galleries have joined the National Portrait Gallery in refusing further donations from the wealthy Sackler family who's come.
In New York City, protesters took over the Guggenheim Museum Saturday night to call out the museum's relationship with the Sackler family, whose company...
The public pressure may be new, but the story is not. Barry Meyer is a former reporter for the New York Times and author of Painkiller, A Wonder Drug's Trail of Addiction and Death. He told us when we spoke to him back in 2017 that the public discourse about chronic pain and treatment has been shaped by companies like Purdue Pharma, with help from physicians, consultants, and yes, the media. Before the term opioid was coined, he said, painkillers were known strictly as narcotics and were associated with dark alleys and lowlifes.
Narcotic painkillers like morphine were used almost exclusively in the 1980s and well into the 1990s for the treatment of cancer and other types of terminal pain. And there was well-founded fears here in the United States that even patients who were dying from cancer were not getting adequate treatments of morphine. There was the concern that, you know, at the end of their life, these patients would become addicted, and it truly was a significant medical problem.
And so the pendulum swung, and you were there when it kind of changed direction back in the early 2000s. How did you come to this story?
We got a tip here at the Times that there was a new drug popping up on the streets called OxyContin, and its producer was promoting this drug as something that was less addicting than previous painkillers, but it had become sort of the drug du jour on the streets, and there was a huge street trade going on in it.
There were people like you who were looking at abuse, but there were others who kind of bought into this narrative that pain was undertreated, and perhaps they were a little naive in doing so. Can you tell me about the kind of stories that were popping up on this subject, the war on pain?
Yeah, there were tons of them in virtually every major publication. Forbes had an article called The Morphine Myth. Playboy did a big interview called, you know, The War Against Pain Doctors or The War on Pain Patients. You know, on the one hand, I think there's a natural tendency for journalists to seize on, wow, there's a problem. We've been laboring under misconceptions about how it should be treated, and we can now address what's like a pervasive problem in the United States. Then there was another class of journalists, many of them with a libertarian bent, who saw, you know, these drugs were safe, they were effective, they were helping people, and their focus was, oh, wow, the DEA is smashing down the doors like the ATF would do with, you know, like gun owners, and standing in the way between doctors who are really just trying to do the right thing by patients and these patients who desperately needed these drugs.
The nanny state is forcing you to live in pain.
Not even just the nanny state, but the police state was doing it. And this whole narrative was fueled by misinformation being generated by Purdue and other people, you know, medical leaders in the scientific community. I mean, people who were dealing with scientific evidence like they were political advocates.
Aha, the experts, the same crowd, cited over and over again the same research studies. Who were they?
Dr. Russell Portnoy was unquestionably the most famous and, as it would turn out, most aggressive.
The likelihood that the treatment of pain using an opioid drug, which is prescribed by a doctor, will lead to addiction is extremely low.
You know, what Dr. Portnoy did, and I believe I was the first person to find this, was to basically take studies that had absolutely no relationship to the long-term use of these drugs and purport that these findings were evidence that these drugs could be used safely with an extremely low addiction rate. He's the one who coined the idea that there was an addiction rate of less than 1%.
I just want to focus on this for a moment because it's astonishing to me how slight was the supposed research. The Porter and Jick study that is at the heart of all this wasn't even a study.
This was a letter that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine.
11 lines long.
Yeah, and it had nothing to do with the long-term use of opioids. It was people who had been treated with opioids and then they were released from the hospital. It didn't follow those people. It didn't look at their use of these drugs over weeks or months. It had absolutely nothing to do with the arguments that were being made by Russell Portnoy or by other advocates of these drugs. Similarly, there was another study at a headache clinic that was again being held up as supportive of the use of opioids or narcotic painkillers. In fact, it's fairly well known that narcotics are a terrible way to treat migraines and other severe types of headaches because they create what's known as rebound headaches. And then the third study was a very, very small study dealing with burn patients. And again, tiny study, tiny number of patients, never following these patients over the long term. I think, you know, underlying that is the fact that the FDA, which is supposed to be sort of the gatekeeper to the approval of these drugs, never required Purdue to do a long-term study to prove the safety and efficacy of these drugs or their ability to addict. They allowed them to basically speculate about that.
Meantime, that pendulum, if it had swung too far to one direction and cancer patients and others with chronic breakthrough pain were being deprived of treatment, around the turn of the millennium, Purdue started taking that narrative very much in the opposite direction, seeking to get OxyContin prescribed for damn near everything. Here's an excerpt from a video series they played in doctor's offices called I Got My Life Back.
They don't wear out, they go on working. They do not have serious medical side effects. And so these drugs, which I repeat, are our best, strongest pain medications, should be used much more than they are for patients in pain.
In 2007, Purdue Pharmaceuticals and three of its executives pleaded guilty to criminal charges based on that campaign. And they were fined $650 million, which sounds like a big number, but is really kind of just table stakes in the painkiller market, huh?
We did the math at one point. It was like a day's worth of sales or a couple of weeks' worth of, I mean, something de minimis when you looked at the total sales.
At some point, a journalist doing his or her due diligence must realize that the narrative is being driven by a relatively small number of people. And nobody, as far as I can tell, until you ever went back to figure out if these were disinterested parties who were honest brokers of legitimate research or shills or some hybrid of the two. How much of this epidemic do you think is attributable to the failings of just basic journalism?
I do believe that, you know, as journalists, we do have an obligation to do some pretty simple stuff. It took me about 3 days to do the reporting that made it absolutely crystal clear to me that the studies that were being held up as the holy trinity of the opioid movement had nothing to do with the use of these drugs. There was a gullibility on the part of journalists. There's stories all the time about, you know, cures for this, that, or the other thing that when you prick it with a pin or wait a couple of weeks, they all turn out to be bogus or ill-founded. There was that, but I think there was a much more pernicious side, which were people who really were sort of industry mouthpieces and shills who not only fell for the scientific data, but made it sort of a cause celeb, made doctors who were running pill mills or mistreating patients heroes in this war against pain. And I can tell you that I'm sure while some doctors were improperly prosecuted, it was also abundantly clear that there were a number of doctors who were criminals and who were using their medical license to make money, to trade drugs for sex with their patients, who were acting in the most deplorable ways.
You came into this story and have kind of chronicled the trajectory of opioids, but it's a story you've sort of seen before because this wasn't your first beat.
There was a period of time when I covered the tobacco industry. Right now, what you're seeing is litigation taking place against opioid makers, much in the same way that litigation took place against tobacco companies.
The state of West Virginia, for example, suing Purdue.
Not only suing Purdue, but suing every other opioid maker as well, because by the mid-2000s, it was not just Purdue that was promoting opioids. It was a range of companies that were making these drugs. And what's sort of fascinating here is that while the tobacco saga took decades of litigation to come to that breaking point, the opioid problem, it's not a long-term health problem. People can become addicted or severely dependent on these drugs within a matter of a few weeks or months. So what we have is this public health crisis unfolded kind of in rapid speed. It's much faster than tobacco, and in many ways, much more complicated. Not only do you have the corporate imperative to sell product, you have a criminal imperative to get these laboratory drugs like fentanyl onto the street. So now, because we'd never dealt with the pharmaceutical end of the problem, when we might have, we're now dealing with criminal enterprises that are selling drugs that are even more deadly than their pharmaceutical cousins.
Barry, many thanks.
My pleasure, Bob.
Barry Meyer is a former reporter for the New York Times and author of Painkiller, A Wonder Drug's Trail of Addiction and Death. As the death toll from the opioid crisis continues to rise, communities have found an unexpected source for understanding its impact: death notices. These modern-day obituaries, published occasionally in community papers but more often online on such sites as Legacy.com, have together chronicled the crisis's individual human toll. We spoke to journalist Anna Clark in 2017 about her article on the opioid-related death notices for the Columbia Journalism Review.
One thing that I've been noticing is how many of these obituaries are very candid, not only that the cause of death was an overdose, but often giving a lot of details about how long this person struggled.
Now, there was a time when obituaries or death notices would go to rather great lengths to avoid talking about causes of death or circumstances that would be deemed shameful. These were things that were hushed up. You know, I'm not speaking only of suicide, for example, or HIV/AIDS, but back in the day, even cancer.
It's so interesting to trace how shame around particular illnesses, which is almost exactly correlated with misunderstanding about particular illnesses, has made families feel like this was something that they needed to hush up, something that they didn't want the neighbors to know, something that when they wrote the last story of this person's life felt like a stain or a distraction. But yeah, even cancer. For a long time, people thought it was something contagious. It affected body parts that were thought to be unseemly.
So what changed?
The story of how AIDS was told in obituaries was really important. It caused a lot of internal discussions among mainstream newspapers about how important it was to mention the cause of death at all, because it was not just outing the fact that they had AIDS, but often cases outing that they were gay. And both of these things had a lot of stigma around them. And if the family felt uncomfortable with that. A lot of papers weren't sure if that was something that they should do. The folks who were at the forefront of shifting this was gay newspapers, and particularly the Bay Area Register, which for a very long time was publishing obituaries of people who died of AIDS with real persistence and compassion. And in some cases, they were the only notice at all that these people had died. Sometimes they were disowned from their families. There was no mention of their passing anywhere else in the world. In 1998, I believe, when for the first time since the AIDS crisis hit the San Francisco area, no one submitted an obituary of somebody who died of AIDS. It was such a big deal that they published both a news story and an editorial about that that ended up going on the wire, being written about all over the country because it seemed like a metric that perhaps, just maybe, there was some light at the end of the tunnel with this terrible, terrible crisis.
Being candid became kind of a political statement because silence equals death. It was a direct act of defiance against stigmatization, shame, and so on.
Right. Early on, I mean, there was literally people working for the White House who described HIV and AIDS as a just punishment for people who were gay or used intravenous drugs. I mean, it was a powerful pushback against that, affirming that there was nothing that these people needed to be ashamed of. And it was simultaneously documenting the human cost of this crisis in a way that nobody else was, in a way that was very, very necessary if we were going to change the attitudes and policy necessary to find solutions.
You've written that the accumulation of these candid obituaries influenced the collective memory. How so?
They're a way of showing what we as a society value and also what we abhor by both what's included and what's left out. When we tell the story of people's lives, it's inherently selective. Taken as a whole, it's a really powerful document of how we change and don't change over time. And I think what's happening now with these opioid obituaries, especially in communities where there is no local reporting, these obituaries carry even more weight in telling the truth about the utter devastation that is playing out right now to the extent of 59,000 people dying a year of this.
Your piece in Columbia Journalism Review begins with a passage from the obituary of a young man named Austin Janatsky from Stevensville, Michigan. Could you read a bit of that for me, please?
Sure. I'll just start from the beginning. Austin James Janatsky, 24, of Stevensville, died unexpectedly on July 2, 2017, when he lost his courageous battle to addiction. Austin was born May 13, 1993, and grew up in St. Joseph, where he attended Lakeshore Public Schools. He was employed at Walsworth Printing. Austin enjoyed fishing, camping, boating, listening to music, and the Dallas Cowboys. Most of all, he enjoyed spending time with his family, especially his nephew Jonathan and nieces Joan and Paige. Austin had a kind heart with an amazing personality and was able to bring laughter to all those who he met. During the last 7 years of Austin's life, he struggled and fought to overcome his substance abuse disorder. Austin was blessed to have the love and support of his family and many caring individuals to stand and fight with him during his battle. Austin attended Families Against Narcotics, where he shared his personal battle with opioids in hopes to inform the community on the dangers of drug addiction and to offer support, acceptance, and encouragement to all who have been affected by this terrible disease. I can go on if you'd like.
No. Those words are having an unsurprising effect on me as I listen to them. What effect do you imagine they have in the larger community and in the larger narrative of opioid abuse?
Sure. Well, I should first of all make clear that I'm kind of biased here. He's part of my extended family. He's my brother's brother-in-law, and this is where I grew up in this community in Southwest Michigan. First of all, it really does humanize and complicate this crisis for people who might still carry a lot of stereotypes about it. I hope it does so to the point where it moves people to reach out for help if they need it, to not feel shame about asking for help for something like this or admitting that they don't know what to do to help a family member who's struggling with addiction. It's also alerting people to resources, you know, Families Against Narcotics, which are mentioned here. Somebody who's reading this might notice that and think, oh, maybe that's a place I can reach out to if I need help. At the same time, it is helping people to see that this kind of crisis isn't just something happening far away. It's not something that's distant. It's not something that only happens to people who, quote unquote, chose it. It doesn't just affect people who grew up in unloving family situation.
It's that nice kid works down at the printing shop.
Yeah, it's affecting everybody. Nobody is safe until we come up with solutions.
Anna, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Anna Clark is a Detroit-based journalist. She wrote about the opioid-related death notices for the Columbia Journalism Review. That's it for the Podcast Extra this week. Be sure to tune in this weekend for The Big Show, where we'll be taking on the coverage of the Mueller report. Also, sign up for our newsletter at onthemedia.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.